Welcome to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. I'm Adina Glickstein, a master's student at CU Boulder. This is a show that asks bold questions about new technology. We join you on the fourth Thursday of every month on the old-fashioned radio, or you can listen online as a podcast. Looks Like New is a production of the Media Economies Design Lab at CU Boulder. This month, our guest is Coraline Ada Emke. She is best known as an activist and software engineer who's spent more than a decade working to advance ethics and justice in the tech sector. As our conversation details, she's also a musician experimenting with modular synths and a practicing occultist. Together, we'll be discussing the role of ethics in open source software communities, queer time travel, and how writing code is like casting spells.
Coraline, thank you so much for being with me virtually today. It's such a pleasure to get to speak to you for your epic return to Looks Like New.
I'm so happy to be here. A lot has happened since the last time I was on Looks Like New, and I'm excited to talk to you about it. So,
terrific. So the kind of impetus behind this recording is that you were planning a trip to Boulder for a residency at the Media Archaeology Lab. And I know you, I think, as many people do, largely as a programmer and an activist. So I'm really intrigued to hear more about your artistic practice. Can you tell me about what you're working on creatively at the moment?
Yeah, I have several things in the works. And first of all, thank you for bringing this up, because I think a lot of people in our industry come across as very one-dimensional because we're so focused on the work at hand that we don't make a lot of time to talk about things like art and things that we're passionate about outside of tech. So I really appreciate the question. I've been a musician pretty much my entire life. I was in Austin, Texas in the 90s when that was a burgeoning music scene, playing live all the time. And I've been a recording musician, I guess, for the past 15 or 20 years. And but I didn't really develop a proper studio practice until the last few years, when I actually started taking music a little bit more seriously and taking myself more seriously as an artist. So I have a few different projects. One is Sudra's Violin, which is sort of post-punk concertos, I guess you would say. And I do a weekly prompt project called This Quiet Junto. I take part in it, where we're challenged to respond to a prompt within 4 days with an original piece of music. I'm doing a piece called Shortwave Prophets, which is a sort of documentary of fringe religious beliefs on shortwave radio. And then I have the project that was going to bring me to the Media Archaeology Lab, which is an untitled project about musical protocols, queer trauma, and time travel.
Oh my God. Musical protocols, queer trauma, and time travel. The first thing that combination of words brings to mind for me is like DJ Sprinkles playing piano for 32 hours. Is that roughly the shape of what you're working on, or what is
no,
it like, you know,
no, not really. Yeah. So a colleague of mine, Dr. Jess Paris Westbrook, did their PhD dissertation on queer identity and queering data, queer research. And one of the things that they explored, they're an artist, one of the things they explored in their dissertation was this notion of time travel to address queer trauma. The idea being, if it were possible, what would it be like for a queer person who has experienced trauma in their life with coming out, with losing friends and family, with all of the other things that can happen to you as you're trying to find your place in the world and you're trying to come to terms with your identity. Like, what would happen if you could travel back in time, change the way you behaved in those circumstances, or take the knowledge that you have now and the confidence that you have now about your future life back with you? What would you say to your former self? Like, what would you do differently if you could be transported back in time? And how can imagining that as an exercise help address the trauma that you still carry with you? And for me, with music being so central in my life, you know, there are songs that take me back to particular places and times and people, some of which are very traumatic in my own personal history as queer and transgender woman. So the project is about using music to revisit these sort of pivotal moments in my personal timeline and kind of rewriting them to be healthier, more positive, more sustaining, more joyful.
So beautiful. And from your description, I can kind of see the analogy to media archaeology as a method, which, right, in brief, is like about looking at devices and hardware from the past, but recontextualizing them into the present to see what lessons they have to offer. How were
It's
you going to explore
exactly.
this idea of time travel at the Media Archaeology Lab?
Well, the first computer that I owned completely on my own was a gift to me from a friend when I was living in Austin, and it was an Atari ST and came with a modem. So this is the computer that I first got onto bulletin board systems with and eventually onto the internet with. But the interesting thing about the Atari ST, and this is where musical protocols come into play, is that the Atari ST had native MIDI support. MIDI stands for Musical Instrument Digital Interface. And it's a protocol that lets electronic instruments communicate with each other. And today it lets computers communicate with electronic instruments as well. So my plan was to use the Atari ST that is there at the Media Archaeology Lab to recreate a song called 1959, recontextualizing it as 1989, a pivotal year in my youthful transition, using vintage hardware, the computer, using the MIDI protocol, which is created in 1983, using modern technology, my laptop, and using reissued vintage boutique analog synthesizers to create the sounds. So it's going to be a mixture of modern and period technology being used to revisit a classic song from my own childhood and recontextualize it as a pivotal moment in my development as a fully formed human being.
Can you give some examples of like what's on the track list when we're talking about revisiting songs that have meant something to you? Are you know, who has
Sure.
influenced you so far?
Well, the one that I've just recently finished, and this was a collaboration with some electronic musicians that I have in my circle. I did a reimagining of the Cyndi Lauper song "True Colors," which originally was recorded as an homage to a friend that Cyndi Lauper had lost in the 80s to the AIDS epidemic. So the song, it's a beautiful song. It's a beautiful pop song. It's very memorable. Cyndi Lauper's an amazing performer. It's a great song, but it has this extra context to it that connects it with the queer timeline, with queer history. So what I did was I created a cover version of it musically, but rather than lyrics, I laid in samples from Lana Wachowski of the Wachowski sisters, the Matrix creators. Samples from Lana Wachowski's acceptance speech when she was given the Visibility Award following her public transition. Her talk was really inspiring to me, and Lana Wachowski was the first transgender woman that I saw out in the world that I could see myself reflected in. So that speech was very meaningful to me at a very critical point in time. And laying those samples in and creating a narrative as part of a reimagined True Colors just feels really powerful and very personal to me.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it hopefully sometime. That sounds really powerful. And one of the things that it calls to my mind, I mean, just the sort of layers of referencing and media snippets and samples and accretion of very personal moments, but like coming together in the idiom of a piece of music makes me think about something that the musician and technologist Holly Herndon has said before, which is that the laptop, which is kind of conventionally thought of as this like cold distanced thing, is actually in some ways the most intimate instrument because we live so much of our lives on it today, or it holds
Yeah.
so many of these references and layers. Like I almost think about search history as like a way of telling the self. And I wonder if that could map onto this idea of queering timelines or bringing the past into the present.
Yeah, that really resonates with me because, I think that's right. I never thought of that before, but the laptop or the studio computer, it's an instrument that you're playing, and you put just as much soul into that as the keyboard or the guitar or the violin or whatever instrument you're using. And it requires a level of technical proficiency and mastery of the laptop to be able to record music professionally. But also, it's such an intimate part of our lives. I spend more waking hours than I'd like to admit on my laptop. And it's an extension of myself in a lot of ways. So it makes sense that it would also be an extension of art.
Do you perform live?
I have not performed live, and I had not performed live for a long time. until 2 years ago. I was invited to perform at an experimental music festival for something called Drone Day in the Hudson Valley, New York. And that was my first performance since the 90s. And it went great. And I was like, man, why am I not doing this anymore? I really enjoyed it. So I do have a music project going on right now, I guess another one called the Disaster Society. And this is designed from the ground up to be a performance project. So it's myself and a longtime collaborator of mine, Kevin B. Chatham, who are taking two people and making a really big sound out of it, specifically for live performance. So I'm looking forward to being out in public and sharing music in a different venue than through the laptops we were just talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you also use some of these like open source musical production tools? Like, I'm thinking about like processing or like Max MSP in your musical production practice, or is your software development kind of separate from your creative practice in that sense?
I'm gonna say something a little controversial here, and that is that in general, a lot of open source tools put user experience and user interface last because they're the communities that form around open source projects are not really conducive to attracting and retaining people who are really good at UI and UX, unless a deliberate effort is made to be welcoming to different ways of contributing. So I think that a lot of open source software suffers from lagging behind interface standards and accessibility standards and some basic usability standards that we're used to from proprietary software. So when it comes to certain things like my creativity, I prefer to use the most ergonomic tool and not really consider if it's a proprietary tool or an open source tool with the same consideration that I might under different circumstances. Because when I'm creating music, I need my tools to be transparent and visible, and it's not something that I think about.
That's a really huge point, and it foreshadows something that I wanted to get into with you, so we might as well just kind of jump into that. But I wanted to
Great.
ask, what do you think is the role of like beauty or pleasure or coziness in making software, and where do you find it to be present in open source? It sounds like maybe not at the level of the user interface always.
No, my view of open source, my view of technology in general has always been that there's a magical quality to it, and I mean this quite literally. I was an occult practitioner for decades and performing not performing on stage, performing acts of ritual and personal transformation through magical practices, magical and spiritual practices. And magic is about taking an idea, taking something that you want to exist in the world and willing it into being. And I think that definition applies equally aptly to programming, where you have an idea, you have a concept, you have this notion that you want to bring into the world, and you apply yourself and your special skills and your arcane knowledge to bring it about and create something brand new. And that's a magical process. So I think that magic has a lot to do with technology, and I think art has a lot to do with technology too, because technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in a techno-social context. And art, society, culture, education, human rights, all of these things are intermingled in the world where technology exists as well. So it has to represent and reflect all of those different varied things as well, or else it's only a microscopic and insignificant slice of what reality is. So all of these things have to come together because in the universe we live in, they all interact.
Yeah, that's so well said. I mean, I really see the connection between writing code and casting spells in the sense that both are like speaking new truths into existence.
And they both
And
use language. They both use language as a medium. Yeah.
And I mean, we were really fortunate to have you participate this past year in the making of a zine that the Med Lab put out, where we gave a bunch of smart people with leadership roles in open source software communities some tarot cards. We drew a two-card spread for each person and asked each of you to
Project
kind
that
of
was so
extrapolate the
perfect.
message from the cards, right, into like a lesson about governance transitions. It was just like as a fun exercise. But I get the sense that was not your first encounter with tarot, like it was for many of our contributors.
No, it wasn't my first encounter with the tarot, that's for sure. But I was so thrilled to be like part of that project, and the concept is so amazing. looking at open source, looking at governance, and looking at tarot, and putting it all together in the classic punk format of a zine. It was just such an ideal project and so well conceived. So yeah, I was super happy to take part in that. I've often used tarot. I used to use tarot in my practice as a tool for kind of tapping into subconscious insights as opposed to, divination. So I found the exercise of being given, two random cards from a draw and told to, think about how they relate to open source governance. Like it was so cool because it invited me to look at something that is frankly rather dry from a magical lens and think about it at a metaphorical level, think about it at an almost spiritual level. And I think when you take a problem, like any problem you face in the world, and in this case open source governance, and you look at it from as you want to look at it from as many different angles as possible, because its truth is complicated and multifaceted, and you can learn more by looking at it through different lenses. So I thought it was a brilliant project.
Oh, it's so cool to hear you say that. And I'm really amazed by some of the connections that you draw between the different threads that we were pulling on, because the theme came about pretty organically. But as I think through it and as the project kind of came together, it did become clear that like what is governance? And that's kind of an open question. We were looking specifically at like organizational transitions in the groups that develop open source software. But fundamentally, it's about like human to human interaction and
Yeah.
relational alchemy and the emergent properties of people with different opinions and perspectives and incentives working together, kind of adjacent to, but not inside like typical market setting to try and create something new together and what comes out of it and what problems arise and how do people navigate those problems. So it really is
Yeah.
a magical or alchemical question in certain
It
respects.
really is. And one of the tenets of alchemy that I've always loved so much is soluit coaguli, which means dissolve and reform. I think by taking things apart, and this relates to the media archaeology lab too, by taking things apart and understanding how they work, we can put them together in new and novel ways and learn from that process. And I think that's what the zine was all about.
Dissolve and reform. Yeah, that's so
Yeah.
it. Are there other lessons from spiritual or esoteric practices that have influenced your thinking about peer production or community governance?
Well, I will say that once on a dare, I wrote an entire talk called Alchemy and the Art of Software Development. So I have thought about this a little bit. So yeah, there are other ways. Well, I've always believed that open source isn't made of code, it's made of people and people who come together to form communities and broadly form societies. And we have to, the work that I do is about people bringing more of themselves into the work that they do than maybe is the norm in our very formal sort of culture of technologists as not being social creatures, like the stereotype of the antisocial coders, the lone hackers, the lone geniuses. The work that I do pushes back against that notion and tries to create spaces where people can bring more of themselves, more of their lived experiences, more of their personality and their beliefs and their value systems, this more of themselves into the work that they do in open source, which I think is necessary for healthy, balanced technologies. Healthy, balanced communities are more likely to produce healthy, balanced technologies. So I think that spirituality, creativity, all of these sort of innately human traits can be real gifts if they are properly contextualized in the work that we do, whether it's our jobs or our creative work or our open source work.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just so detrimental, this myth that technology is the solo endeavor. And maybe even getting back to this idea of the laptop as an intimate instrument, like
Yeah.
it's so personal, but it's so networked and relational and social.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, please go ahead.
Oh no, please.
I was just gonna to back up a little bit and kind of set the stage for the rest of our conversation. I want to make sure we're making this really accessible to folks who might not know that much about software production.
Sure.
So, could you just give a quick and dirty intro to like what is open source software and how is the way that it's made different from, say, how Google develops new products?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that. So there's an umbrella term that we use, which is FOSS, FOSS, and FOSS stands for free and open source software. And free software and open source software are philosophically aligned. but distinct, and they have their own adherents. But in general, what distinguishes free and open source software is that you can inspect the source code, you can contribute and change the code, and you can redistribute your modified copies. That's what it boils down to. It's a set of intellectual property guidelines enforced by licenses. But open source is also a lot more than that, because open source is a place where communities of interest can arise around solving certain techno-social problems. And these communities can bring together people from literally every corner of the world. Anyone who has access to a personal computer and the skills and the free time, which are all qualifiers, can theoretically participate in an open source community and contribute to an emerging technology. And open source code that was collaboratively created in the open and freely distributed, powers about 87% of companies in the world. It powers most of the internet. It powers the backbones of the internet, the servers that we rely on, the databases that our data is stored in, the browsers that we use. Open source is everywhere, and it's kind of invisible, which also makes it kind of magical, right? Because it's this invisible thread sort of tying the techno-social world we live in together. And it's all from volunteers, which is also pretty magical and amazing.
Yeah, that's quite extraordinary. And what you just said makes me think about this sort of oft-cited quote about what is infrastructure. And like infrastructure is, roads and like subsea cables and telecom wires and like water pipes. But the sort of quip about what is infrastructure is it's the stuff that you don't notice until it stops working.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
in a sense, I think that's true of the literal code that's produced by open source, but also of the community interactions that are like the infrastructure that creates the infrastructure in a way.
And it's kind of a new notion. I mean, it's within the reasonable memory lifespan of a contemporary technologist that we started talking about open source projects as communities. This is a new development. It used to be all about the code. It used to be all about meritocracy. It used to be, it didn't matter. Like your identity was irrelevant. Instead of a gift, it was irrelevant. All that mattered was the code that you produced. And to transform from something like that to where we are today, where we have codes of conduct, we have community governance, we have group decision making, we have consent. We have people who are thinking about downstream applications of the work. We have all of these really human social activities happening as we like coalesce in the communities around these different technologies, which is pretty amazing and has such tremendous potential for broad social good.
Yeah. So to sort of unpack that, some people might be moved to think that on the face of things, a world where there is no identity, where there's only the code, where it's not about who wrote it, but it's just a pure meritocracy, is actually is in some way progressive or is conducive to horizontality, if not equality. And that's kind of resonant with like the early techno-utopian writing about the beginning of the internet. Could you talk us
Absolutely.
through a little bit about how that, that myth of the meritocracy, is not actually the road to equality?
Sure. I think the history of meritocracy has been talked and joked about quite a bit. It was intended as a satirical look at the future of British society. But the idea that we can solve problems of identity by removing identity is kind of simplistic when you think about it. Thinking that who you are and what you've lived through and what you've learned by what you've lived through is irrelevant to solving a problem, that just makes no sense to me. And I find it frankly dehumanizing, because the most valuable possession that we have as a human being is our own identity. And if our own identity is irrelevant to what we do, then what are we even doing?
That's beautifully put. And it makes me think of the kind of double-edged sword of my own early experiences on the internet, where on the one hand, I felt this freedom to not be who I was away from the keyboard and, to be in queer spaces more freely than I could offline, or to to talk to people without any presumptions about my identity being made based on how I looked or how I presented myself in the material
Sure.
world. But then on the other hand, of course, the lessons that I had learned through embodied experience came to bear on the way that I conduct myself online and on the kinds of things I make, the spells I cast with my words.
Yeah.
So it's really urgently important to destabilize some of these concepts like meritocracy that I think can all too easily be taken for granted as like a social good.
Yeah.
And maybe the same is true about like decentralization, right? People hear the word decentralization. They hear that a tech project is building something decentralized and automatically assume that means that it must be more horizontal or it must be more equal, more invested in equity
Sure.
than like a centralized Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon kind of company. But that's so not the case.
That's it. Yeah, it really is not. And when we, and I think it comes back to what you were talking about before about infrastructure and when it works and when it doesn't. We're seeing the infrastructure of corporate social media revealing itself to be quite an ugly machine, and we're looking for alternatives. And decentralized solutions are very appealing, given the societal trauma we've just gone through with the transition from Twitter to X and the things that Meta has been doing for a decade and so on, ad tech, surveillance capitalism, techno-fascism, everything that we were worried about is seems to be coming seems to be coming true now. I think the most important thing we can do as an antidote is to think about how we use our own agency, and more importantly, how we can distribute agency. Identity really is about agency, and the scenario you're describing, my own experiences of experimenting with gender identity in an online setting where, no one knew who I was aside from the information that I presented through a very specific channel, and that was very freeing. But the difference between that and having your identity stripped away for meritocratic purposes is agency and consent.
Absolutely. I mean, I hear something kind of similar being talked about in like privacy discourse, where
Yeah.
the right to privacy or anonymity isn't about withholding everything about yourself or, being a non-person. It's about having the agency to consensually reveal details about your identity as you see fit, not as Google sees fit, for instance.
Exactly, and giving us more control over how what we create and what we say is used. I think decentralization allows us to compartmentalize our lives in different ways, that I think is actually quite healthy. And I think compartmentalization and federation of identity, but the lack of compartmentalization and the federation of identity was one of the big problems of centralized social media, because it took control over our thoughts and our relationships and our work out of our control and centralize that control. It stripped us of our agency, and it fed a system that we were all ethically opposed to but had no alternative to. So I think a situation like the Fediverse, other decentralized networks and protocols, they give us more agency than we would have in a centralized platform. And I think that's the key thing that we want to stay focused on as these technologies develop, is maximizing and distributing agency. It's just that is, I think, so central to pro-social outcomes in tech.
Yeah, and I think it's just becoming impossible to ignore. Like, there have been
Yeah.
several sort of watershed moments, maybe the Cambridge Analytica scandal being one of them, or
Yeah.
like moments when Palantir has been in the news being another, like where it just seems like centralized social media and the structure of like data extraction and algorithmic control that are baked into these platforms, it's just like untenable. But I really think the last couple months with the shift from Twitter to X, and now Meta's appeal to the political right, and the Trump administration being hailed for quote unquote saving TikTok, it just really
Yeah.
feels like a turning point where the dominant Silicon Valley paradigm is like undeniably unusable for
Yeah.
anyone with like an ethical conscience. But
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people who don't feel so fluent in the technical side of things, or who haven't been exposed to like the Fediverse before, the prospect of exiting from these mainstream platforms feels really daunting. And I wonder if you have any advice for folks who want to start divesting their attention and their data from these platforms, but don't really know where to start.
I think with where we are today, honestly, we need a buddy system. I think we need people who are familiar with alternative social media platforms and alternative other platforms, photo sharing, what have you. We need to do our part to bring our friends and neighbors and families away, along with us, because kind of what I alluded to earlier with the music software, our open source software is not necessarily the most usable, the most ergonomic, the most standardized, and even some of the core concepts. Like when you go to join Mastodon, it's like, okay, pick your server. Oh, what's a server? And why does this question matter? And how can I be informed enough to make a decision like that? That's where we need human intervention and human discernment. And we need to be good to one another and help each other find these new platforms and find our way on them. Just like somebody did to us when we were younger.
Yeah, I'm still someone who's very much in the process of discovering the landscape, open social networks and decentralized alternatives to the main platforms. And I owe an immense debt of gratitude to my very patient friends who have onboarded me. So I love this notion of a buddy system. Are there like particular open social platforms that you think are easier for beginners to get into, or maybe more worth the startup investment in, given their like long run benefits?
My main social platform these days is Mastodon. And I'm still learning a lot about Mastodon and about the way it works both under the hood and socially. But I think Mastodon is probably the easiest to understand. And we have what is it called, PixelFed, which is photo sharing now. I think the degree to which we can use familiar metaphors from centralized software, but bring that decentralized ethic and ethos and architecture to the solutions, we're probably going to have a better time onboarding people. And it can be very tempting to reinvent things that maybe we found annoying with the old platforms, or things that we found comforting with the old platforms that we want to bring along with us. I think it's a balancing act between, taking the familiar and making onboarding easy for people, but also not repeating the mistakes of other centralized platforms. So I think really at a moment like this in time, where we're seeing these mass migrations off of corporate media, this is where open source needs to really be at its friendliest. And really be on its best behavior and really be trying very hard to be approachable to non-technologists and extending freedom and opportunities to people besides other developers.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And I think we're seeing a lot of that happening in practice with the beginnings of an exodus from X or Twitter to Blue Sky, which is interesting to me because it's not actually all that decentralized. And at the level of protocol, it, is ostensibly more like billionaire proof than Twitter. But power is also controlled by a relatively smaller subset of people. And the idea that users could credibly exit is like the main reassurance against the sort of capture that happened to Twitter happening to Blue Sky as well. But because it's like similar to Twitter and seems accessible to former Twitter users, it's grown much more exponentially than like, Mastodon seems to have in the fallout of Elon buying X.
Totally agree. And I also use Blue Sky, and I've kind of my approach to social media these days is kind of like a mullet, where it's business up front and party in back. So I use Blue Sky for talking about my book and talking about technology and talking about my work. And I use Mastodon to talk about music and more personal stuff. So, and you know what? I think that's fine, because I think that lends itself to the kind of compartmentalization that was missing when our entire lives were splashed across our Twitter and Instagram and Facebook feeds. I think a little bit of compartmentalization can go a long way to keeping us healthy and in control of the media that we consume. So I don't mind the fact that there's not a single Twitter replacement. I don't mind that there's not a single Facebook replacement. I want us to be experimenting, and I want us to like maybe not recreate that winner takes all attitude that we saw over the past decade.
Right. Why do we need one platform with like the best algorithmically governed feed to give us the best content? I heard someone refer to TikTok as the everything box the other day, and I found that totally terrifying. Like that there's one feed that is totally opaque that has an algorithm that seems to reliably predict what you're interested in, choosing from everything is, it should
Yeah.
be terrifying to us. That doesn't suggest like healthy internet use.
No, not at all. And
I'm glad you're.
it feeds into an addictive lifestyle. When I left Twitter, I got so much of my life back. I got so many minutes adding up into hours of my day back. I shed a lot of stress and dread. I wasn't constantly in a panic about every world event that happened in real time. It was amazing. And just the ability to step back away from that everything box for a little while. We need to remember to do that for our own well-being.
Yeah, I mean, my screen time dropped off pretty dramatically when I stopped using Twitter as much. Although,
Sure.
admittedly, I'm still on it, but my main social media at this point is I have two Mastodon instances. I'm on a Solarpunk one and a NetArt one, and those are kind of the only feeds I really want to scroll these days. And they're
Yeah,
certainly more rewarding than the everything box. Maybe
for
not as
sure.
rewarding in terms of like dopamine circuits, but holistically, it feels a little better.
We've been rewired, and we can open up the panel and rewire ourselves just as easily.
Yeah. So on just on the subject of, open social media and alternatives to the mainstream platforms, this year in MedLab, we're running an incubator program where 10 activists and organizers from all over the world, from all different countries, are piloting new open social media spaces on various tools and platforms, including Blue Sky and Mastodon and even Noster, that they can bring back to their communities. So sort of like this buddy system you were describing. And
Yeah.
within this program, we've adopted your contributor covenant as the
Oh,
basis for
wow.
our code of conduct for our work together.
Amazing.
For further listener context, Coraline Ada Emke's Contributor Covenant is a code of conduct for contributors to open source software. Its purpose is to reduce harassment of underrepresented software developers. Over 100,000 open source projects have since adopted the Contributor Covenant. More information at contributorcovenant.org.
Yeah, everyone kind of hacked it and added on according to what they felt like they needed to have written there to comfortably inhabit this space where we're all working and learning together. And we're in the process of reaching consensus.
I am so glad to hear that because I think for as codes of conduct became normalized, they're in danger of being a copy and paste. Not really something you think about, not really something you put effort or energy or thought into. So I am much more interested in adaptations of Contributor Covenant than I am in adoptions. So I'm very glad to hear that that community felt that they had the agency to take the document as it was written and make it their own, make it an expression of their own values and their own rules and norms. That's the way it should be. So good job.
It's been a really enlightening process. I'll also say I have a newfound appreciation for the importance and also kind of the difficulty of establishing like a collectively held code of conduct. It
Yeah.
seems like it could be an infinite process. Like as we continue to move along in our work together and new considerations surface, it always feels like there's something to be added. And I'm just, yeah, newly attuned to how like open-ended of a project establishing a code of conduct for a space is. And it almost feels like impossible to put an end date on it or to make it like immutable in something like a software license. So what kind of tools
Yeah.
do we have to keep these like living documents?
Well, I think as we've seen the shift from open source project to open source community, we saw the need for social norms, which is where a code of conduct comes into play. And then what you're talking about is a community that has now established itself, has agreed on a core set of values, and is doing their thing and living their lives in the world, creating things, studying things, learning things. So of course they're going to be changing because the people are changing. And when things change and we need to collectively decide what to do, collectively examine our values and how our communities work, that's where governance comes into play. And I think governance is a natural evolution of where open source has gone over the past 10 or 15 years. because now we've recognized that we're communities. We're recognizing now that we have important decisions to make, and keeping our founding documents valid and reflective of current realities is part of that work. It's part of the work of keeping a community organized and healthy and relevant. It's always revisiting those shared values and always revisiting those shared norms, because social contracts, unlike licenses, are constantly being negotiated and renegotiated. And a code of conduct is essentially a form of a social contract.
Yeah, and it really speaks to like the possibility space that exists in open source that is not really available to users of centralized tools. Like, governance is hard, right? And everyone talks about how it's like a lot of effort and we don't really know how to do it, but it's also a deeply valuable process that gives these protocols like a whole new life of possibility, whereas like Google doesn't care what you want from it. You have no voice. You don't even really have the right to credibly exit. So the idea of a code of conduct, and, you know, in fact, the very name, which explicitly uses the word code, even though a code of conduct is not a piece of computer code, reminds me an idea that comes from my friend and teacher, Melanie Hoff, who proposes that anyone who interacts with computers is, in some sense, always already programming, trying to sort of like demystify the idea of SSHing into the mainframe. Like, we're all engaged in programming sort of social software, and also literally through our computer use, changing the like directories and file systems. And even if we're not like writing in the terminal, we're all kind of always already programming. And I like that reframe because I think it kind of highlights how like things that have historically been considered non-technical are also important to the culture and outcomes of the tech industry, not just the computer code being written in programming languages that only a select few know how to interact with.
Yeah, exactly. And I've spent a lot of time learning and studying and writing about a guy named Eben Berkley, who is an early responsible tech advocate and an early computer scientist. He co-founded the Association for Computing Machinery and published the world's first computer magazine, Computers and Automation. And he believed that the key to the responsible development of technology consisted of two main components. One was accessibility, and the other was responsibility. And by accessibility, what I mean is how understandable the system is, how easy it is to model, to understand how it works, and to interoperate with it. So understandability, and then taking responsibility for how the technology is used, for how it's created, to what end, how people come together to create it, how it's deployed, and how it actually impacts the world. You know, having the ubiquity of computers is something that we dreamed of during our cyberpunk adolescence. But the reality is that we are so surrounded by computers today that they're invisible to us. So we don't even know when we're programming, and we don't know what kind of power we have. We don't know how we can use the machines that are all around us every day in novel ways to create something new or solve a problem or subvert a system that's oppressive. And that's the kind of hacker literacy that I would love to see come back.
Yeah, I love that. I'm working on my hacker literacy right now by taking my very first baby steps into working in the command line. It's intimidating going beyond the graphical interface. As someone who's kind of long considered myself not very technical, pushing past those first boundaries and realizing that my computer is not actually just like a series of windows on a desktop.
Sure. But
I can navigate it almost like I'm playing a text-based role-playing game. It's sort of fun and exciting. I think that's a kind of an interesting segue into talking about your ethical source project. Could you give like a broad overview? What is ethical source, and what's your role in establishing this new way of thinking about software development?
Sure. Well, the notion of ethical source came about in 2019 at the height of an activist group called Mahinte's No Tech for ICE campaign Twitter account, because back then we were able to use Twitter to organize. From their Twitter account, they started tweeting a list of tech companies that had contracts with ICE and were therefore contributing in some way to the human rights violations at the U.S. southern border. And one of the companies that they called out was a company called Chef, which makes open source infrastructure software that powers a lot of the servers, powers a lot of the cloud. And there was one particular developer who had worked at Chef, who had developed quite a tool chain of open source tools around the Chef technology that a lot of people depended on. And when he learned that the company he worked for was participating in human rights violations, he decided in an act of conscience that he would pull his code from the world. He pulled it off RubyGems, where the packages were distributed, and he pulled the source code off of GitHub, where it was hosted. And within about 2 hours, his code was restored because Chef had intervened, GitHub had acceded, and RubyGems had no choice but to go along with what they were being told with regard to intellectual property. So this developer was trying to exercise their right to conscious dissent, and the open source establishment prevented that from happening. And I saw that as such a tragedy and such a moral failure on the part of the open source establishment. So I sat down and wrote my own software license, the Hippocratic license, as a way of like really engaging with the question of whether licenses were keeping us from exercising our moral authority or not. So I wrote the Hippocratic license, which was designed to promote and enforce the basic human rights outlined by the United Nations. And it attracted a lot of attention, a lot of media attention, and a lot of enemies, but also some allies. And I was challenged when I came up with the term ethical source. Well, what does ethics mean? Ethics are slippery. They change from place to place and from person to person and from time to time. So I was suddenly being presented with a question of, well, what do you mean by ethical? I knew better than to try and answer that question on my own. So I put together this group of allies and formed this community and formed this nonprofit organization called the Organization for Ethical Source to explore alternative ways, besides just licensing, alternative ways to create equitable outcomes in technology with a specific focus on digital culture and open source. So that's kind of the story of where we came from. And today we're an organization of about 500 volunteer members. Contributor Covenant is now stewarded by the Organization for Ethical Source, and we're working on a 10th anniversary version 3.0 of that document. We are working on governance documents. We're working on all of these tools that together we call the ethical stack, just a set of tools for addressing ethical challenges at every stage in the life cycle of an open source technology. And I retired from a 26-year long career as a software engineer to run OES full time.
In the last 10 years, what are some of the ways that you've seen the sort of general public understanding of technology's relationships with ethics change? Like through some of these watershed moments, maybe that we talked about earlier, were those like consciousness-raising moments that really powered the people behind a project like this? Or is there still kind of a lag in terms of persuading people that like tech ethics matter and we need to get out ahead of crises like No Tech for ICE?
It definitely is still an uphill battle because of the origin of ethical source with the Hippocratic license. A lot of people sort of paint us with a licensing brush and are dismissive of ethical licenses and therefore the rest of the work that we do. But we see the problem of bringing social responsibility and ethics to tech as a long-term project with a lot of small steps along the way. And a lot of very difficult decisions to make along the way, and different difficult things to design and to think about and accommodate. It's a really big problem, and it's bigger than any one person, and it's bigger than any one community. But I like to think that what we're doing at Ethical Source is bringing together the people who care deeply about these problems, even if we don't always agree on the solutions. But just bringing people together across, boundaries, across technical boundaries, across geographic boundaries, across political boundaries, to come together and work on problems of social responsibility. I think that's kind of magical. And to be able to have a part in creating a place where that kind of work can happen is my privilege. But we have a long way to go. I think we're seeing more stories of abuses of technology come out, which will certainly help the cause. People are slowly becoming aware of the role that invisible technologies are playing in their lives. The outrageous example of supermarkets changing their prices on the fly people are witnessing their victimization at the hands of oppressive technologies. And I think that that could help swing the pendulum toward more ethical tech. That's my hope. But the first people we have to convince of that are the developers themselves, which is also an uphill battle, because we're raised to believe that we're building hammers and that tech is neutral and we're sold on that whole bill of goods. So if even we don't care about the ethics of what we're building, how can we expect the public to, you know?
Yeah, I mean, what you're doing is so critically important. And you can't see me, but I'm laughing right now, because a lot of the concerns that you've just raised in some ways for me are like isometric for some of the fears that a lot of people in the tech community have around artificial intelligence and like the AI alignment problem. My perception of the, you know, open source heads or like really technically sophisticated people that I know is that they're really concerned about like the existential risk of developing artificial general intelligence. And many of them are really deeply committed to exploring ethical questions vis-a-vis like what AI can do and making sure that we don't accidentally subject ourselves to like becoming paperclip manufacturers for the AI overlords. But what they kind of miss in some of this alarmism is like, what if some of these ethical considerations are already happening in the present at the hand of software we have today? An ethical source addresses that so elegantly. Like, it's not a far off future problem. The problem is already here, and we can start working on it in ways that affect people's real lives right now.
Yeah. And I don't want to show for my book, which you can learn all about it, thehammerbook.com, available from A-Press in March. I'm kidding.
No, please, really, show away.
but one of the points of my book was that it's not a new phenomenon. Like, the book traces the history of responsible tech going, I could have gone back a lot further, but starting with the Manhattan Project. And you had scientists that were unleashing an incredibly destructive, devastating power on the world and had to live with that, had to live with the work that they were doing and the reasons they were doing the work and the consequences of it. So like we've been struggling with technologies that threaten to destroy us for as long as we've had technology. It's not a new problem. And I think treating it like a new problem and disconnecting ourselves from our lineage of other people who have cared about the role of technology in society really limits us and limits our imagination and constrains our ability to make change. So the book, We Just Build Hammers, addresses the neutrality of tech and uses a sci-fi lens to sort of connect us as modern, as contemporary technologists who care about ethics and social responsibility, to show us that we're not alone and this is not a new struggle and there's a lot to learn and a lot to be inspired by.
And the book is out in April of 2025?
March of 2025 from A-Press. It's called We Just Built Hammers, Stories from the Past, Present, and Future of Responsible Tech.
Incredible. Well, we're coming up near the end of our time here, but I want to ask, are there any other projects in progress that you want to plug or draw our audience's attention to?
I would say keep an eye on what the Organization for Ethical Source is doing in this year and next year. We focused a lot on certain intersections around codes of conduct and governance, but there are other areas, other parts of the life cycle that we're going to start targeting as well, including developing what we're tentatively calling an ethical pre-flight checklist, which would be a set of guidelines and questions and discussion points for deciding whether to bring a technology into the world in the first place at all, like before the first line of code is written. So we're really focusing on the entire life cycle of technology, and our special emphasis soon will be on innovation and how to innovate responsibly. So I would say keep an eye out for our work coming in that direction.
You just tapped into so many really critical questions in this moment, and it's going to be exciting to see how these conversations develop in the near future. But Coraline, thank you so much for your time today.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the work that's happening, the work that I'm involved in, and to understand through your questions, kind of like your perspectives and your concerns and your broader concerns about the society that we live in and the technology that impacts it. So I've learned a lot from this conversation. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU Radio, a show that asks old questions about new technology. We've been speaking with Coraline Ada Emke about open source software, ethics, and magic. Find out more about her work at www.where.coraline.codes. I'm Adina Glickstein, a master's student at CU Boulder and a research assistant at the Media Economies Design Lab. Looks Like New is a production of CU's Media Economies Design Lab. You can find out more about our work at colorado.edu/lab/medlab. Subscribe and find past shows at lookslikenew.net. If you liked what you heard, please spread the word about this show and consider leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts. We would also love to hear from you with comments and guest ideas. You can reach us at medlab@colorado.edu. We hope you'll join us next month. Thanks again for listening.